You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Hello, Launch Street. Tamara here, your host, and clearly the person that forgot her headphones this morning. So there's a little bit of echo in the intro and outro, not through the interview itself, just this part. I'm not even sure what I did with them. Who knows? Anyway, the other thing you should know is I was, and really still am, an avid reader of The Onion. Now, why does that matter? Because today we have the esteemed pleasure of interviewing Scott Dickers, who is one of the founders of the very first ever fake news newspaper. That's right. The Onion is pure satire, but they were doing it long before the late night shows came along. I used to love picking up their newspaper in the convenience store in New York City before I went into work. It was so good. It is still good. All right. This interview with Scott is an inside look at creativity in action and how humor can unleash innovation. Let's get to it. Hey, Scott, thank you so much for being here today.
It is my pleasure. Nice to be with you, Tamara.
Yeah. So tell me, what's your first memory of being innovative?
Well, it goes back pretty far. I don't know how old I was, but I was really young, like 4 or 5. Like, my mom taught me how to read and write before I went into kindergarten. And I realized that I could publish books. So I bought those little spiral notebooks that you get at the corner store. And I wrote books. And they were cartoon books, like with funny stories. And I did ABC books. And I didn't sell them, but I gave them to my parents and to my grandparents. Like, that was the scope of my audience at that point. But I was hooked. Like, I loved this idea of creating funny things and showing them to people. I got so much love and attention from that, that it implanted in me really early that, this is a thing that I should be doing.
Oh my God, I love that story. So I have to ask, like, did you have a favorite genre? Were there books that people requested from you?
Yeah. So the answer to those two questions is the same. The books that people liked the most, I experimented with a lot of different kinds of books, but what people liked the most were ABC books, where I would just do A is for whatever, and I would come up with funny things that it was for, or a theme. And I came up with characters that would recur. So yeah, it was the ABC book. I had this character, and this is before Waldo, but he wore a red and white striped shirt and blue pants, which is what I wore every day. And
that's so funny.
Yeah. He was just this like cartoon character that I had who had no fans and just existed in this little world of my head and people who saw these little books.
My God, that is. Do you have any of those still?
I sure do.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
I love it. Yeah, no, they're fun. They're fun to look at.
Yeah, I bet. And actually, you know, you sharing that kind of makes sense to what we're talking about today, fast forward all these years, and kind of, you know, the work that you do. So I just want to get all of our listeners on the same page, because you're from the Onion, which was truly the world's first humor website. And talk a little bit about The Onion, and if you could weave in there, what made you decide, oh my God, yeah, this is a good idea. We should totally launch this. Because this really, when The Onion started, and you know, I'm in my mid-40s, so I was there for the beginning of it. That was before that kind of humor became a little bit more commonplace.
Yeah, The Onion really did start the whole fake news
trend.
And so not a lot of people know that The Onion started as a newspaper in 1988. And it was a business idea hatched by these two guys at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where I was a very successful local cartoonist. And so they brought me in to this project of starting this college humor magazine. And you know me enough already to know that anything having to do with writing down funny stuff and giving it to people was all
clearly
I was about. So I was like, great, let's do this. And the idea that you could make money at it was exciting to me. I had figured out how to make money at it through cartooning, because that's very similar. Draw pictures, write a little thing, put it out there, people pay you. But this was different, to own a publication. So this is a new step for me, but it was a natural progression, and I was all over it. And it was hard, but it was like the fun kind of hard. Like, you're working constantly, you're laughing uproariously, you're going crazy. You know, nobody made money. None of us made money. We all had other jobs, you know, service industry jobs.
Yeah.
For years, as we put out The Onion every week, just delighting and entertaining ourselves and hoping that it would appeal to students on the campus. That was our primary audience. And we just kept doing it and kept getting better and kept growing and kept making more money and increasing our circulation. And when the internet came along about 10 years later, maybe 8 years, we decided, hey, we're doing this newspaper every week anyway. We might as well make what's called a website and put the stuff on the internet.
This new frontier.
It was indeed a new frontier. And overnight, like, our readership increased by a factor of like a trillion.
Yeah. So what do you think, why do you think The Onion resonates with so many people? And I just have to tell you, before our interview, I pulled up the most recent, because I was like, oh, let me see. And I, by the way, remember when it was a newspaper, because I lived in New York City in 95
right.
To 2001. So I used to pick it up on my way to work. It was one of the wonderful other newspapers. I know, it was so great. But I was just laughing because the headline that came up when I pulled it up online was, it just did things. New Game of Thrones trailer confirms season 8 will reveal identity of sword-covered chair. It's just hysterical. Yeah. So why do you think, though, that this type of newspaper and this type of comedy, why do you think it resonates with so many people and has such a huge following?
I've thought about that a lot. I think there's a lot of reasons for it. Without getting too into the weeds, in comedy, what people really respond to is something that's fresh and original and different. Because surprise is like the core element of good comedy. And when The Onion came around, there was nobody else doing that type of comedy where you were parodying news and making it funny.
Right.
So having established ourselves as the progenitors of that, and then having everybody copy it, and then having The Daily Show grow out of that, and The Colbert Show grow out of that, this whole world of comedy news is so competitive now that you can't really be seen. But just the fact that The Onion is the first one and the original one and still arguably does it better than anyone else. And I can say that because I'm not there anymore. And it's people who I hired a long time ago who are running it, who really know what they're doing. And besides that, it's also everything we learned over the years doing The Onion was about kind of the same thing it was about for me when I was a kid. This is a way to get love and attention. So if you can make people laugh and delight them repeatedly, they'll love you for it. And you get addicted to that, and you want to do it more, and you want to do it better. So at The Onion, we developed all these different types of humor and these strategies for connecting with people. And I wrote a whole book on this called How to Write Funny. It's basically my recipe for how to actually write comedy really well. It's a nonfiction book. And there are so many little tricks and tactics that a professional comedy person will use. And most of the comedy we see on TV or in movies or whatever is working at a pretty high level, and it's doing a good job. But at The Onion, we always wanted to maximize that, optimize it, and really have it be this powerful laser of comedy that would just pierce into your brain. And somebody once asked me, did you call it The Onion because you knew that people would be laughing so hard they were crying? And I thought, oh my God, can you imagine the chutzpah of that?
Right.
But when it started, so no, but we got to the point where, you know, we'd get letters every day from people saying, oh my God, I laughed so hard, I couldn't breathe, or I used to be depressed, and then I started reading The Onion. So, you know, we did crack some sort of code, and there's a little bit of secret sauce in that. And I tried to spell it all out in my book. But yeah, it would be a little bit much to go into some of those details in this interview.
Well, let's dig into some of the skills, though, because you do talk about kind of, you know, comedy being a skill that you can learn. But before, now I have to know why you called it The Onion, because that's what I assume, too. So can you tell us why? why it's called The Onion? Before I can't leave that open loop in my head.
Yeah, so a couple of reasons. One, it's a great name for a newspaper because it's like you peel back the layers to get at the facts. But it was never used. It was never in that pantheon of acceptable newspaper names like Beacon or Herald, probably because it's just a little off. It's just, you know, it's just a tad bit off. And so it seemed like a good name. And also Chris, one of the two business guys who helped found it, used to eat raw onion on untoasted white bread.
Oh, God.
For breakfast. So, yeah, those are the two main reasons.
That's gross. Okay. So thank you for sharing that, though. I just needed to know since it wasn't sure what I thought. What I find intriguing, though, about what you're saying, Scott, is that you were able to take something that I think we all see as a very magical thing that's hard to deconstruct, and you've deconstructed it in a lot of ways, or at least figured out some formulas or skills at work. And I think in your book and in some of the articles I've read, you talk about comedy writing being a skill you can learn. Can you share with us some of the maybe easier parts of that that kind of we can learn?
Yeah, and I love doing that. I love deconstructing things, and I think that's what appeals to me about humor, because humor is taking things in real life or imaginary scenarios and then deconstructing them or making you see them in a different way that makes them really amusing. And so stepping back and doing that on a more macro level, looking at the whole process of how you write humor and trying to figure that out and deconstruct that was really interesting to me. And now I'm doing that. I'm stepping back even more and doing that with, well, how do you build a successful brand? And I wrote a whole book about that as well, because I feel like I cracked that code as well, because not only did I build the Onion brand, but also the AV Club and my comic strip before that, and another brand called the Weekly Radio Address, which was like a six-figure podcast that I had going for many years, and now this How to Write Funny business. So it's like a thing that I feel like I understand and can repeat. And so I always want to explain that to people and teach people how to do it. So with comedy, and I did start a program at the Second City in Chicago in partnership with The Onion, where we teach people how to write prose humor, like the written word. And a lot of those people do go on to work at The Onion on TV and on Clickhole and stuff like that. And so, yeah, I'll just give you a couple of tips from that program. One of them is, a lot of people who first start out, they're like, well, how do you come up with the ideas? Where do you get your ideas? So the best way to come up with ideas is to simply sit down and write them. And I don't mean to be flippant about that. I mean, you have to sit down and just start writing and not worry about whether what you're writing is good or not. I think a lot of people fear that, well, if I start writing and it's bad, then it means I'm a bad writer. And why am I doing this? How do you write good things? Well, you write good things by writing bad things. You have to write badly a lot and keep writing. And eventually you're going to hit on maybe something that's not so bad. And so this principle of quantity to achieve quality is really central to my philosophy of humor. And also at The Onion, The Onion produces thousands of headlines a week, and then they weed through all the garbage to find the gems, to find the ones that people look at and they go, oh, that one's not bad, you know. And then they'll finesse it maybe or whatever, look at it in the bright light of day after putting it on a short list and realizing, okay, yeah, that one's pretty funny, and then executing it as a story.
So this may be an obvious question, but how do you then, so let's say you have a whole page of ideas, whatever it is you're doing, whether that's, you know, a comedy bit or anything really, but how do you then filter through and say, all right, here are the ones that are worth moving forward and here are all the ones that are going in the trash or saved for later?
Yeah, so there's a very specific system for that. The first one, you just have to learn the best practices. Like, there are 11 funny filters, I call them. These are professional tools that comedians use to make ideas funny. And you have to look at your ideas and ask yourself, okay, does it abide by the rules or the guidelines of each of the 11 funny filters, or one or two of them at least? And if it does, then you know just from your internal judgment that, okay, that idea has some merit and it should be saved on a short list. That takes some practice. You know, you have to learn what those funny filters are and have a good internal sense of them. If you're not there yet, if you're just starting out, a really good way to do it is to, well, there's two. One is you can forget about what you wrote, set it aside, and then come back to it a couple weeks later after you've forgotten it and look at it with fresh eyes like a reader. And then you're just using your internal taste and of what you think is funny. And if something strikes you as funny on there, then it probably is, you know, semi-objectively funny and might work with a wider audience. And then the second way is actually show the work to an audience. Go to an open mic night and read some of the material. Which ones get laughs? There's the absolute final barometer of what's funny right there.
Right, if other people actually respond to you or not. And I want to go back to what you said about filtering. I mean, it seems to me that one of our biggest challenges in being creative in any way is our desire for it to be perfect out of the gate or to judge it right away. So how do you stop yourself from getting into that analysis mode too soon and really let it flow? And how do you teach others to do that? Because I do think, and regardless of if it's humor or something else, but I think you really hit on something with that comment.
Yeah, no, it really is critical. You have to embrace the fact that 95% of everything you come up with is stupid and garbage.
Yeah, it's so hard though, isn't it? I mean,
it can be, yeah, because there's a myth that a good writer can sit down and crank out gold. And nobody does that. Like, that's just a terrible myth that you see in movies about writers or TV shows about comedy people. It just doesn't work that way. Comedy people write a lot of garbage, and they're just better at other people at weeding out the garbage and finding the stuff that might actually work. So yeah, part of it is just embracing the fact, knowing that that's part of the process, and being comfortable with it. Because if you're not comfortable with sitting down and writing garbage, you're never going to get to the good stuff. And I guess that would be the main thing. And the other thing, doing it more, you get audience feedback and you start to feel good when they like the good stuff. And the more you produce, the less pressure there is on all the material or on one individual piece of material to hurt your feelings. Like, if you write one idea and it's terrible and you go out there and show it to people and they all say that's terrible, you're going to feel terrible.
Yeah, because that's all you got.
It's all you got. So write 20 ideas. And I always tell people that. They'll always come to me and say, oh, I have a great idea for a headline for The Onion. And I always have to tell them, please don't tell me your one idea, because I'm not going to like it. And then I'm going to make you feel bad when I tell you that. So come back to me with 20. And I'll probably say, oh, you know, number 8 isn't bad. And then I basically have told you 95% of your stuff was terrible. But I've at least given you some glimmer of hope and shown you how the process works, that, hey, if you want good material, it's quantity that's the key.
Well, and that's a really, I think, a really powerful thought for us on Launch Street to really think about, around not getting hooked on only having one quote unquote perfect idea. But you're right. If you have 12 different cupcakes to pick from, it's okay if a couple of them don't taste as good. You can just move on to the other ones. But when you only have one, like, that's it. That's all you got. And that's a harder thing to emotionally remove yourself from.
Yeah. And that's tough in comedy, especially because people attach their comedy ideas to their own self-worth. And so if somebody doesn't like it, they just feel awful. And you just got to get over that, and you got to embrace the quantity.
So in all your experience with, you know, The Onion and the other businesses you built and, you know, writing your book, How to Write Funny, which of course we'll put a link in the show notes to.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, of course. Were there any lessons or skills that came out of your experience that actually kind of surprised you? Like, oh, this works, or this process actually is good. You know, I think sometimes along the ways, especially when we write stuff down into a book, we realize, oh, that surprised me. I didn't expect that.
Yeah, that happens to me a lot. I'll just pick a recent one. So I'm really introverted, and I really don't like being with other people. I don't like going to parties. Dinner parties are like literally the worst thing ever. And so I'm alone a lot. And I look back at some of my work and I see this level of reclusiveness in some of the characters and in some of the comedy. It's this very like almost on the spectrum. Like it's almost autistic in terms of how, boy, I just don't connect with other people at all. And so for most of my entrepreneurial career, I thought that was a real liability, because to be a business person, an entrepreneur, to be successful, you need to go out and meet people and shake hands and, you know, have lunch with people and all this sort
right.
of stuff.
Be an extrovert.
Be an extrovert. And I used to do that stuff. I would hate every second of it, and I would need to, you know, recharge and recompose myself for several days after each lunch meeting. But I would do it because I thought it's what you had to do. But recently I was looking back and realizing, no. Yes, that is, if you have that skill and you're an extrovert, do that. That works for you. That's great. But I have skills too. Like I can sit at home and write a book all day, every day for weeks. And so I can produce a lot of books and I can produce a lot of content. That's also a strength. So it's like embracing what idiosyncratic strengths or perceived weaknesses that you might have, and realizing that they're, you can make it work, whatever your unique abilities are, even if the wider society might see them as detrimental even to success.
You know, it's funny. You just brought up some memories that I haven't really thought about in a while, but, and I won't cry, don't worry. But it reminded me of, I'm dyslexic. And, you know, I think in the educational system, that's always a challenge you're trying to overcome. And later on in life, because I'm in the innovation space, right? All about new ideas, new thinking, new ways of looking at stuff. It actually really worked in my favor because I saw it differently because I frankly just read it differently to begin with. So my starting point was always different than everybody else. But something that used to be my, I don't know if called weakness, but a real challenge for me, turned out to be my greatest strength in the business that I'm in because of what it produces. And I've never really thought of it that way, but it's kind of like thinking about your superheroes, right? It's always the thing that makes them weird or different that turns out to be their greatest superpower.
It's a great analogy. And I love that story. I'm so glad you brought that up. I feel that way about how I manage people. So I've always seen the good in people. I've always been one of those people who says, I don't believe in bad people, only bad management. So I can always find a gift in someone. It's a talent I have that I bring to my work as, you know, a business leader, I guess, is seeing someone and knowing, they're really good at X. And then, giving them the space to cultivate that ability and really thrive. And I never did that to myself. I always did it to other people. So recently, having learned that same thing about myself, like you learned with being dyslexic, me being an extreme introvert, like a recluse practically, and seeing that as a strength. And with The Onion and The Onion's writers, I always did like people who were weird and who had no social skills and who were failures at pretty much everything else, because they fit in. They're like, these misfits and weirdos were exactly the kind of people who had the crazy ideas that came out the funniest, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's such a great lesson in really finding your place, you know, and kind of what you do and what you're good at. And I always botch the sayings. What is it? Is it Einstein that said, like, if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, you'll think it's stupid or something. I can't remember exactly what it is. Something like that.
Yeah. You know, that's good.
Yeah, it's something similar, but same kind of point of, you know, if you put me in a place where it's all about logistics and details, I'm probably not going to be a very good employee. Mm-hmm. Because that's not my strength. That's my weakness, actually. So I love what you're saying about kind of finding these misfits and finding and making that really a strength for you and for The Onion, because their skill is in that weirdness.
Yep, absolutely.
I want to take humor to a bigger place for a second, because I know we think of humor, and I do a lot of keynote speaking, which means that we're always thinking about how do we get a laugh, not necessarily just to be funny, but just, right? That means the audience is engaged. It's, you know, always breaks up seriousness. But I've also found that humor is really important in communication overall, beyond just, you know, telling jokes. Not that that's not hard in itself, in my opinion, because it is. But when you think about kind of the power of humor and making people laugh, what do you think it really does?
Yeah, I'll get back to what I said before. It's a way to get love and attention. You know, in my sort of weirdly introverted and reclusive borderline autistic brain, it's a tool. It's literally like a tool to belong. And so to a more socially well-adjusted person, it's social lubricant, you know, it's a way to bond with people and a way to make people like you. And those are, I mean, that's incredibly valuable. So we all have some ability to do it. We all laugh. We can all make fun of ourselves. We may not be joke-telling experts or whatever, but people want to like us and they want to find us funny. They want to bond with us. So it's really our race to lose, especially doing a speech. You know, I give a lot of speeches too. And I've tried to, over the years, just get really comfortable on stage with just talking to the audience as opposed to presenting to them. And that's been a big part of it for me, just being more personable and being myself, because I think I'm just me and I'm just a normal me, but to other people, I'm amusing and weird. So being able to embrace that and understand that and be cool with that and use it to bond with people is great, because for a long time, it was a source of deep insecurity for me.
What do you mean?
Well, being weird is not the most prized quality, like high school, junior high school.
Right, no, it's
school.
Not.
You want to be the opposite. So, but you know, I think we all know that the nerds and the weirdos are usually the ones who come out of all that the most successful.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah, the high school football quarterback and homecoming king is probably still working in the machine shop back in the town where you came from. So, yeah, that's, you know, humor, when it's presented as like professional entertainment, I feel like is a very different beast than interpersonal humor and just talking, because that's much more based on your own personality and it's self-depreciating and it's bonding. You can tailor it to the individual that you're having a conversation with. So it's kind of a whole different thing. And it requires so much more of you. Like, you have to be confident. You have to be socially aware. You have to have like a high EQ. And you don't really need any of that stuff to present jokes in a publication and put them out, you know?
Yeah. I want to ask you a little bit of a personal question, if that's okay.
Sure.
So, you know, you've mentioned, you know, quite a few times about being, you know, an introvert or different or weird, which a lot of us can relate to. And yet somewhere along the way, you kind of embraced that, right? The thing that makes you unique. And
only recently.
Yeah. So, okay. So my question to you is, and I'm not even sure how to say it, so bear with me as I fumble the question itself a little, but, you know, what was that transition for you from trying to maybe fit in a little bit more to kind of letting the freak flag fly, as they say? Because I do think, you know, I think even as adults, a lot of us, particularly in the work world, are doing everything we can to fit in. And I think, unfortunately, what that really does is it not only squelches who we really are, but it squelches our ability to innovate and be creative and kind of,
yes,
you know, to bring those things that we could be bringing to the table. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that transition for you and maybe kind of how you felt before versus after and how your maybe work or your life changed because of that. There was a lot layered into that, so hopefully it made sense.
No, it totally makes sense. And I weep for all the companies who are not as open as The Onion was when I was running it, because I celebrated people who were weird and different, and I wanted them to be who they were at the office. But in most companies and, you know, in most societies, you know, any part of society, your family, your peer group, whatever it is, conformity is so huge. And it's just a deep human need.
And it's a massive pressure.
It's a huge social pressure. And it's not the need of the individual to conform. It's the need of the group to want, they want the individual to conform. And so there's all this pressure and you get it growing up and everything. For almost all my life, like as far back as I can remember, I didn't like that pressure and I resented it. And I always said in high school, I sort of had this phrase that I would say, which is, if everybody else is doing it, there must be something wrong with it. And I was literally an iconoclast, and I would purposefully do things that were completely different from the way other people did them. I remember one time I lived like two or three blocks from my high school. Instead of walking to school one day, I crawled to school.
Because everybody else was walking?
Yeah. Just, you know, I'm gonna try something different. Yeah. I saw a guy on TV broke the world record for crawling. He crawled like 35 hours. And I thought, that's really interesting. I'm going to crawl to school. And it created such a sensation. Like I had never experienced anything like it in my life. Everybody talked about it. They talked about it for years after. The police were called, crowds gathered. It was really outrageous. And so I got positive feedback from that. And I liked that. But most people, you know, they're not going to have that experience. They're going to feel the pressure and they're going to succumb to the pressure to conform. And it's tough. Like it's tough to convince the larger society to accept you for being different. But I'll tell you my story of like when I let my freak flag fly. So it was very recently I got divorced. You know, I separated from my wife, and for many years I tried to be in a normal relationship and do the normal relationship things, going out on date night and celebrating holidays with guests. And you, as you can imagine, now that you know me, those things,
not your thing, it turns out.
I hate those things. But I was trying to play along. I thought, hey, relationships take work and you have to compromise, you have to give, you know? And so I tried and I did all those things. And I really don't like holidays because holidays are the ultimate conformist. That's where conformity reaches its absolute peak.
Yeah.
So, but I was playing along and I was doing it because it was what you did or whatever. And when we split up, I was like, oh, a side effect of this is I'm not doing holidays anymore. Like holidays are gone. And so now when there's a holiday, people might say like, you know, happy whatever to me. And I'm like, hey, yeah, whatever. And I'm literally like in my house writing, I'm working, I'm not seeing family, I'm not going anywhere, I'm not sending out any cards, I'm not doing anything. And it is pure bliss. And everyone I tell this to envies me. Everybody's like, oh my God, that's so amazing. How did you do that? Nobody gives me gifts. I don't give anybody gifts. I don't do any of that. The only holiday I celebrate is my son's birthday because he's 11 and you have to do that.
Yeah.
And it's cute.
And that's
it's
for
fun.
Him, not for me.
And I love him.
Yeah.
And I'll do that for him. But he knows where I stand and he knows how I feel about everything else. And he's happy and grateful that I make this exception for his birthday. But yeah, for everything else, that's been so great because holidays now are some of my most productive days because nobody bothers me.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. So I won't travel over the holidays, which drives my family's bonkers, but I don't want to deal with it. And I don't want to deal with the people and the pricing of airlines just because it's the holidays to be shoved in a house for a few days. So I totally hear you on holidays, but I think more importantly with what you're talking about is you just said, hey, this isn't for me. I'm going to do it my way. And it works. And it's so freeing, I think, to get to that point where you can recognize, I mean, yes, you do things for other people when they matter to you, like your son, but to just recognize like, hey, this is my way of doing it. And I'm going to make this work for me because this is who I am versus like, oh, to your point, and using the holidays is a great example because that's when we're all supposed to do exactly the same thing. So,
yeah.
You know, versus saying, and if that's your thing, good for you. Like if you love that, great. but really recognizing who you are and what you want out of kind of how you operate in the world, I guess.
Yeah. And I get that from my family. Like, I'm a guy who marches to the beat of my own drum, but my older brother is far more extreme in that way. When he was in his 20s, he really just didn't want any kind of conformity in any way. And he lived outside for a year in Wisconsin. He lived in a horse barn.
Oh my God, that's so cold.
And made his own clothes. He would find roadkill and like tan the hides. He just wanted to be completely out of society. So I'm weird and I do things differently, but I consider myself to be pretty based in reality compared to my brother, who really took it to an extreme. But I admire that and I celebrate that, because he really just like wipes the slate clean and says, okay, how do I want to live? And then just makes it up from the ground up.
Well, and I think for us Launch Readers too, the other real kind of thing that's really sitting in my head as you're talking is this idea of not just being who you are, but celebrating who other people are. And I think this is especially true, not just in family units and personal life, but in work as well, where we're trying to kind of move something forward. It's been my experience that the best way to reach your goals in work and life, really, is to actually allow people to be them and to come together in that way and kind of use that diversity as a point of strength versus trying to get everybody to work in the same way. And I think that's one of the big mistakes we make as leaders, regardless of what you're doing, is trying to get everybody to work in the same way and be in the same way versus using those differences, because they really are an advantage at the end of the day.
Yeah, I'm so big on that, and I couldn't agree with you more. It's how I've always run my teams, absolutely. And not only celebrating the individual gifts of each individual person, but fostering a culture in which everyone else respects and celebrates everyone's individual differences and what they bring to the table. Like, yeah, that's absolutely the diversity is the source of our strength. There's no question about it.
And don't you find too that you know, it's been my experience that ideas that come from a birds of a feather tend to die, because frankly, they're just not that good. It's all the same people with the same perspective, same experience, looking at the same data. But if you get a group of people who think differently or see the world differently or just ideate differently, the ideas that come out of that tend to be a lot stronger, because really it's like storming a castle. They're just kind of battle tested from all sides.
Yeah. So in the book I wrote, Outrageous Marketing, which is the story of the onion, that's the subtitle, the story of the onion and how to build a powerful brand with no marketing budget. I break down what I thought were the key principles that I used to build successful brands. And one of them is to defy convention. Because I looked at myself and the onion and how we did things. We didn't do things the way you were supposed to do them. We did them in many ways the opposite of the way you're supposed to do them. And I studied other companies, other successful companies, and found much of that same thing, much of that same urge to look at things completely differently. Don't do them the way everyone else does them, just because that's the way everyone else does them. That's really the only way you're ever going to innovate.
But can you give me one example, I guess from The Onion, I think in particular, of how you did it differently than what everybody else did?
Yeah. So when the internet, I'll give you a couple. When the internet started to become a thing around the year 2000, everybody said that you need to engage with your customers online and you need to interact with them and build a community. And we didn't do that at The Onion. The whole idea of The Onion was, we're a parody of a big faceless news organization, so we need to pretend that we don't care about the reader. In fact, we're going to berate our readers and tell them that they're ignorant dullards who we're going to hand them the truth, and that's the truth, and they don't need to know anything else. That was kind of our shtick. And we never allowed comments on the website. We never interacted with people on social media. If someone comments, the Onion still to this day will never respond to any comment.
That's like the opposite of what everybody tells you to do.
The opposite. But what I determined when I looked back and tried to come up with these principles, there's a higher principle, which is you need to be the truest, most outrageous version of yourself and your brand as you can. And the Onion's brand is fake newspaper. So if you're parodying a newspaper, you need to act like a newspaper and make fun of that. And the way you do that, like I said, you have to ignore customers, make them feel like you're just this ivory tower media elitist telling them what the truth should be. And they just have to take it. That's funny. And that's part of our brand. And so it really would be a violation of the brand to do it the way you're supposed to do it.
Well, and don't you find too that, and I've made this mistake in the past, is I've jumped on whatever bandwagon that obviously works for everybody else. And because it's so noisy by the time I got there, because I wasn't the first one to do it, it doesn't work anyway. So even if I, you know, like using engaging on social media as an example, even if I try to do that the way the other, you know, brands who did it first say to do it, I don't know, it tends to fall short because it's just too noisy already anyway.
Yeah, well, you know, you're all about innovation. And so being the first at something is always going to obviously make it easier because it's not as crowded. If you're just following the herd, you're always going to be having a harder time because everybody's there doing the same thing. So, but I do that stuff, like I'll learn a new trick or a best practices or whatever, and I'll try it and I'll learn from it. It usually takes me that step to learn how I really should be doing it. Like I do it the way everybody else does it first and like, oh, okay, this doesn't work for me. Now I'm going to do it my way. Now that I know kind of what the core purpose of it is, I'll figure out a way to achieve the same result, but with a totally different strategy.
Well, and I think that's a great lesson for all of us about taking all these best practices and success stories that we hear out there and at least putting them through the filter of, you know, how do I apply this and stay true to what I'm doing? And my business and my brand and my personal, you know, who I am personally too. Because there is this trap of like, oh, it worked for them, so I'll just follow their model and I'll be, and it'll work for me. But it never seems to work out that way. At least not for me. I've not cracked that code.
Yeah. I always admire people who have an internal sense of that and you see it in action. You'll see them say, I heard about this new strategy, but it doesn't work for me. It's not going to work for me, so I'm not going to do it. I'm like, oh my God, that's so impressive. Like I would have to actually, I would literally take a course and learn the strategy and I would do it and I would fail at it. And then I would say, oh, okay, it's not for me. People who know themselves so well where they can just say, no, that's not going to work for me. And I'm trying to get better at that. So sort of one of my goals for this decade is to just get better at knowing myself and instinctively, not wasting my time doing something in a way that doesn't work for me.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what I've learned in innovation in particular, and you know, my definition of innovation is thinking differently about what's in front of you to create a competitive advantage. So it doesn't have to be, you know, the next blue skies idea or the next Uber. That's not what it's about. It's about, you know, looking at what's right in front of you, but from a different lens so that you can come up with a better way to do it in some way.
Yeah.
But one of the things I've learned in that is it's not really the best innovation isn't about not the best, but one way to innovate isn't just about taking what other people do and trying to model that, but going outside your world and then understanding the principles behind it and bringing it back. Somebody was telling me the other day, it's a very simple analogy, but or example, that the, remember the, you know, the Heinz ketchup bottle? I don't know if you remember when it became that plastic upside down bottle. It used to be the glass bottle and you had to tap it. Remember on the Heinz 57, right?
So that was a revelation to a lot of ketchup eaters.
I mean, it was game changing in my house because it, well, actually we had a competition of who could get the ketchup to come out. Like we'd all bang it in different ways. Whoever won got the first bite of dessert. So I miss it a little bit. But
you probably don't remember the ad in the 70s with that song Anticipation.
Oh, I don't remember that.
You should look that up.
I'm going to.
Heinz embraced that and were trying to make a joke about it, but then ultimately they knew, okay, this is a problem. We're going to fix it.
Yeah,
okay,
right.
Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
Right. No, that's great. I'm going to go find that. But one of the things that they did was they looked outside their category and said, who's doing interesting things in packaging? And actually shampoo and conditioners were one that had turned stuff upside down. So I think there's a lot of power in learning lessons from outside your category, but I don't think there's a lot of power in copying best practices of your competition, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I get that.
Yeah. So, okay. So let's go back to you for a second. You know, you've shared a lot about you. So when you think about how you innovate, how do you work? How do you come up with this stuff? Is it, I know you said you do a lot of writing. Is that your core way of, you know, kind of getting those creative juices going?
It's one. I also think really well on my feet in a group when there's like group brainstorming happening. It's like brains are being put together and the sum is greater than the parts. That's always really exciting. And just like the adrenaline boost that I get from being in a group and talking with other smart, funny people. Sometimes I'll just hit on an idea in a way that I won't when I'm by myself writing, which is surprising given that I am an introvert. That's the one time when I feel like I'm better in a group. But a lot of times those ideas aren't great. I put all the ideas in the same pile and try to assess them on their merits later.
So
I would go back to that principle of quantity to achieve quality. That's where I think I get my best ideas, is by coming up with a whole bunch of them and then weeding through them and finding the ones that I think are the real gems.
I think that that's key. Your ability to analyze later. In fact, they've done studies, right, of the brain. You can't actually innovate and analyze at the same time. So you have to do one or the other. So if you think you're innovating, but you're analyzing at the same time, you're really analyzing.
Well, yeah. In teaching comedy writing, I talk about the two halves of the brain. There's the clown side and there's the editor side. And the clown side is the innovator. That's the part of the brain that can spew any idea. There's no judgment. It's free flowing. Everything's great. And that's where you're going to get the good ideas. That's where you're going to pour out a ton of ideas. The editor side of the brain is where most people are most of the time, especially as adults, because as we grow up, we realize, ooh, everything that my clown brain is saying is inappropriate to say, and oh, that's silly. So we want to be buttoned up and we want to be responsible adults. And so we judge everything. We say, well, that's not good. That's not appropriate. That won't work. And we criticize, and that's not good. Like, you need both to be a good leader and to be a good writer and to be a good person, I think. You need a balance between the two. But most people are way overweighted to the editor side of the brain.
Yeah, and I think it squelches our ability to play on the other side, even though we think we're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually not.
Right. So you have to cultivate that.
Yeah. No, I think that's really important. So before I ask you the last question, where can people go to learn more and connect with you?
I'm on all the stuff. I'm on Instagram at It's Scott Dickers, and it's 2 K's, no C in Dickers. And on Twitter, I'm just Scott Dickers. My website is scottdickers.com. I also have a website, howtowritefunny.com. And I have a podcast called the How to Write Funny podcast, where I interview people in comedy about the real nuts and bolts of that.
I saw that, by the way, and I didn't know of it before, but I started listening to it as I was prepping for this, and I listened to the one with Titus, who I just love him. I think he's one of my favorite comedians.
He's great.
Super
great guy.
His ability to take real world pain and turn it into comedy.
Yes.
Is just brilliant. I think from someone from the audience, it's like, it's just genius.
Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah,
that's his central skill, I would say.
Yeah, no, I used to love his show. I was so bummed when it got canceled.
Great show.
Oh, yeah, so good. Way ahead of its time.
It was.
Yeah. All right, so last question. What's the first step we Launch Streeters can take to up our comedy skills? What's one thing we could do right now?
Right now, what you can do is write for half an hour without stopping. And without judging anything that you write, just fill 2 or 3 pages with whatever comes out of your head, doesn't matter what, for half an hour. And if you do that again tomorrow and then the next day, pretty soon you're going to unlock that clown side of your brain in a way that you didn't know was possible. You're not going to realize how blocked you were. Because ideas are just going to start pouring out of your head and you're not going to be able to stop them.
And is it okay if I start with, I don't know what to write, I'm writing, I saw this funny thing today, like just
you just have bleh. It exactly right. Yeah, you have it exactly right. You're not going to show this to anybody. You're going to delete it as soon as you type it, unless you came up with something interesting, you want to copy it, just that part and paste it
it's
somewhere.
It's the process.
It's the process, yeah.
Yeah.
You need to get your brain back in that space it was in when you were 3 years old, when you would say whatever you thought and you thought it was wonderful.
Oh, I miss those days. Scott, this has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you for coming by. And more importantly, let me thank you for allowing us to get a little bit more kind of personal on it too. I think even though we're a business innovation podcast, I think that personal side of it is as important, actually really what drives our success ultimately. So,
yeah, cool. It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Before you go, what's your one takeaway? For me, it was around the carrot and the stick. I'm going to take a step back and explore where I have both, or maybe where I need a carrot, or maybe where I need a stick. So hey, do me a favor. If you're getting value out of my interviews and want me to do more of them, go to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. Remember, more reviews equal more guests, and that equals more value for you. Tamara, out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, LaunchStreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.